You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko pūtoku ingoa, no mai hari mai ki te wire mo tēnā rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for the first Thursday, the 19th of January. It's Pearl here, your host, and my producer Mac is with me in studio as well. Hi Mac.
Hi Pearl.
Hi. Okay, coming up on the show today, BFM reporter Amanda Robinson is speaking to Margaret Taylor from Amnesty about the early release of Chelsea Manning. My producer Mac talks to Murdoch Stevens about refugee conversations in an election year. We also have Andrew Little on for our weekly chat. We'll be talking a little bit today about what's been going on with the Pike River mine. My producer Mac is also talking to Susie Dawson, a Kiwi journalist who is currently seeking asylum in Russia. And finally, I speak to Neve Perrin about her plans to travel to the United Arab Emirates to make a film about the youngest and only female figure skater from the country to complete fully clothed in a hijab. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call 309-3879 or you can text in on 5395. All right, let's get into the show.
You're tuned into The Wire.
All right. Yesterday, Obama reduced the sentence of WikiLeaks source Chelsea Manning to 29 years. In 2010, Manning released a trove of documents to WikiLeaks regarding the wars in Iraq, including policy to ignore torture and civilian death. Most people convicted of leaking have received sentences of between 1 and 3 years. Reporter Amanda Robinson spoke to Margaret Taylor from Amnesty International about the historic move and started off by asking what the situation with Manning is.
Yes, Chelsea Manning was a US Army private who actually leaked classified government material to the website WikiLeaks, and that material highlighted human rights violations and potentially breaches of international humanitarian law by US troops. For that crime, she was sentenced to 35 years in military prison. More recently, she has become famous as because she announced that she was transgender and wished to live as a woman, and so is famous also for being a transgender inmate, but one who very bravely is both a whistleblower but a human rights defender.
Absolutely. And what has happened as a result of that whistleblowing? What has happened to those suspected of criminal responsibility? To just, like, have they been brought to justice at all?
No, the truly appalling thing about this case, not just the 7 years that Chelsea Manning has been held in really bad conditions in prison, is that those implicated by the information she revealed have never been brought to justice. Now, that includes grave human rights abuses and by the military. So Amnesty International is calling for those people implicated in such violations to be investigated and brought to justice.
Absolutely, and Amnesty International is also calling upon President Obama to use his executive power in his last couple of days to pardon Edward Snowden. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Edward Snowden is a whistleblower who shared US intelligence documents with journalists, and that was in June 2013. Effectively, we're asking President Obama to pardon him because what he revealed was the fact that the US government was secretly hoovering up huge chunks of our personal communications, private emails, phone locations, web histories, and so much more. Basically, it was the US government which was in breach of human rights, not Edward Snowden.
Yeah, definitely. And it seems as if Obama is kind of using these last few days to do what he can in his term as president. How do you think cases like these will be dealt with under a Trump government?
Well, irrespective of whether it's a Trump government or an Obama government, Amnesty International is a human rights watchdog, and we have and will continue to call for the protection and promotion of human rights by all presidents and by the governments that they represent, actually. So we will continue to campaign for the strongest protection and promotion of human rights by president-elect.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Amanda talking to Margaret Taylor from Amnesty International about the early release of Chelsea Manning yesterday. Next up, my producer Mac has a story.
Election year means issues like immigration will be brought to the political forefront, but how does this affect refugees? I spoke to the man behind the Double the Quota campaign, Murdoch Stevens, on what this might mean for those seeking refuge in New Zealand. I began by asking him whether yesterday's announcement that potentially the first refugee MP is running as a candidate for the Green Party changed the discussion at all.
I don't know if it'll change the specific discussion. I think in terms of what the quota level is, which is mostly what our campaign is, I don't think that'll necessarily change it because we've already made a huge amount of progress on that. What I think it will change is it'll mean someone is at least inside Parliament, if not inside the leading government, that really understands intimately these issues and has been affected by them. And even though like a lot of people in the Greens are already very strong on human rights, there is something about being actually from a represented group who are affected that just makes your analysis so much sharper and so much more immediate. So I think that will be the main benefit if Gauri Skaraman becomes our first refugee MP.
Mm. Yeah, and going into an election year more generally, which party do you think best represents the interests of your cause, that being doubling the quota and funding for refugees, if any party at all?
I mean, historically, most people would have said the Green Party is the best on this. So before the campaign started, both the Green Party and United Future were saying the quota should be increased to 1,000. At this stage, the Green Party, Labour and United Future all say 1,500. It should be doubled. And there have been hints at that from the Maori Party as well. But strangely enough, in the last couple of months, Gareth Morgan's Opportunity Party has come out with a policy of saying the quota should be 2,000 places. And what I like about his party is he's not really looking at political sentiment or opinion polls or anything. He's looking at the facts of how we stack up compared to other countries. And he reckons, at least in his post on this, that most of these other parties haven't really looked at the policy, and it's not a policy-based analysis, it's more political. But, I mean, given the historical commitment to human rights, it's pretty hard to go past the Green Party's platform on this.
When you're looking at whether a party is representing refugees well in their cause, are refugee quotas the only measure of that? I mean, are you worried about other cuts to immigration, which all the major parties have promised?
Yeah, it's an incredibly complex issue, right? Because we have, you know, refugees are 1/28 of our new permanent residents, and we have people coming in from all sorts of strands. Under the humanitarian broader quota, we have, say, the Pacific Access quota or a Samoan quota, where we, part of the government policy is we bring in people there that don't necessarily meet the points system, but because they're part of our Pacific community, they are welcome to come into the country. So, yeah, it is a worrying year in terms of immigration. And it's also pretty topsy-turvy in terms of who has historically been liberal on immigration and who hasn't been. And yeah, there's an incredible amount of sophisticated discussion that needs to go on, which frankly isn't happening right now. And I hope we do get good discussion, but elections is generally not the time when we get those kind of talks.
I guess it's kind of a hot topic right now, being driven by, you know, what's happening all around the world.
Yeah, with Brexit, Trump, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, in New Zealand, I think it's more driven by housing. And it's a real shame when immigrants are scapegoated for problems that are really to do with housing speculation, predominantly by New Zealanders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a class issue rather than a race or an immigration issue.
If you did achieve these goals of doubling the quota and so forth, what do you think would the next step be?
Well, it depends. Hell, I'd like a holiday, but the next step in New Zealand would probably be, so that was really just making up for 30 years of inaction in New Zealand.
Yeah.
But we still won't be anywhere near matching countries like Australia or Ireland, and certainly not any of the real leaders like Canada or Germany or Sweden. So in the midterm, and I'm not the only one to have said this, all the churches are saying it as well, and most people who care about human rights, we should be aiming to be equal with some of those other countries. So the Anglican Church, the leader in New Zealand, said we should be tripling the quota. So it's actually kind of quite a conservative position, the one that we took 3 years ago. I mean, people said it was radical at the time, but it's become quite conservative. There's also going to be the introduction of community sponsorship either later this year or the start of next year, which has been so successful in Canada, where church groups or any other groups can get together and put down a deposit and bring a refugee or a family into the country. And then they try and set them up with work. And if they're able to get them into work and if there aren't these other costs, that deposit stays in the bank and they can use that to sponsor another family to come in. So if people are sort of cost neutral, then you can keep bringing more people in as long as they're not, you know, a burden on the state, which they don't tend to be after a short amount of time. So that's a pretty exciting direction that people could go in. And we've got a lot of contacts throughout this campaign and a lot of people really wanting to do their part during this crisis, but simply not being allowed to because the government hasn't yet implemented the system.
Right, right.
On the broader scheme of things, I mean, it would be much better if the Syrian war wasn't taking place, that there weren't 5 million people fleeing the country and another 10 million displaced internally. So there's a whole lot of peace work that needs to revitalize in New Zealand, mm-hmm. which is kind of strong against the Iraq war, and because New Zealand's not really involved in Syria, there hasn't been a lot going on. So for me, in the long term, like, the refugee campaign is kind of bringing in refugees is not the solution to any of this. And if someone had the solution, well, good on them. Good to see them try and get it done. But at a grassroots level, we do need to be, anti-war and pro-peace.
The Wire.
That was my producer, Mac, talking to Murdoch Stevens. We'll be back after this with Leader of the Opposition, Andrew Little.
95 BFM. Back for 2017. Refreshed, renewed, and ready for more rare and remarkable radio. Now with a brand new, fully functioning website.
It works!
A refurbished news pod receiving dispatches from all over the world and beyond.
And under the Official Information Act, he's actually required...
An in-house advertising corner dedicated to maintaining a high standard of quality, cut-through creative. And all this surrounded by a choice collective of dedicated music enthusiasts and radio hosts, playing the best of everything you're unlikely to hear anywhere else. Original originator for music, news and points of views. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device at 95bfm.com.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Yes, you're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We have on the phone Labour Party leader Andrew Little. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Good, that's great. So you announced yesterday that you were challenging the government to support a bill that will allow for the full recovery of the Pike River miners. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, I won't necessarily allow for the full recovery of the miners. What it will do is allow the re-entry to the drift, which is the tunnel way that goes up to the mine, which is what the families want access to. Now, providing, of course, that the reports from the experts that the families have got and whatever reports the government have got say that the risk is as low as the experts are saying as it is, then, you know, we're saying that should be the conditions to allow access to the mine. The government said their most recent kind of excuse for not supporting this is to say, well, there'd be too much liability on the directors of Solid Energy, the legal owners of the mine. So I'm saying, well let's deal with that. Let's pass a law in Parliament that says that those directors won't be subject to the liability, providing that the proper precautions have been taken. What we can't do is have a situation where the government says that, you know, there has to be absolutely zero risk in terms of re-entry, when you've got experts saying that, of course, there's always a risk, but the risk at the moment of re-entering that mine is at such a low level that it is feasible and practical, and also the correct thing to do, to make an effort at re-entry. And the reason why the families want that is not because they expect to recover every single, you know, one of the men who are there, but to know how far any of them might have got and if there's any evidence that will help in any, you know, further investigation into the causes of the exposure. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing for the families to be asking.
Yeah, definitely. How do you respond to Environmental Minister Nick Smith's comment that, you know, that this is contradictory and unsafe?
I mean, that's an excuse that they're falling back on. And, you know, we've had the fact that the families have gone and got international experts who, based on the information they've got, have said, no, on all the indicators are that there's a level of kind of stability in terms of the atmosphere and the mine that in anywhere else in the world would be acceptable conditions for attempting to re-enter that part of the mine workings. So that's what that is now. The government just seems to be turning an absolutely deaf ear to anything the families say. Of course the families have got a stake in this. They're the ones who've lost their loved ones, and they just want to do, as the government promised them, anything that can be done, you know, will be done, you know, within the bounds of appropriate safety. But there are still stuff that can be done, and that's all the families are saying. So you promised us, let's do this one last thing, see if we can get entry, and just see, in terms of however far we can get, just see what is there. Because if it is possible that one or two or however many of them might have got a little bit further up the drift, further up that little the tunnel that leads to the mine, then let's, you know, recover that, and let's see if there's any other evidence that tells us what the causes might have been. I'm just surprised that the government is being as obstructive as they are on this issue.
Yeah, and I mean, New Zealand First has also been talking, you know, Winston Peters has been down visiting the families of the Pike River miners. Is this a move perhaps you feel like you've been pushed into because of New Zealand First bringing it back to the forefront again, or has this sort of been in the works for Labor all along?
I've personally been involved in the Pike River tragedy and the aftermath since the 19th of November 2010. This is anything new to me, and I've been integrally involved in the follow-up to it, the inquiry, the Royal Commission of Inquiry, the aftermath of the Royal Commission, the law that's been passed in Parliament, because I became an MP as the legislation came to Parliament. I've known the families for all that time, I've been involved with them. This is nothing new to me. And when they came to Wellington last year, I was pretty clear, of course we support them. And they've got their report, the government's got their report. I've said, you know, it is time for the government to back off, sit around the table with the families, work out what can be done, and that remains the position. So I'm no Johnny come lately to this. I've been fighting this corner for the last, you know, 6 years and more, and will continue to do so. And in terms of mine safety generally, of course, my involvement goes longer than that. I led the union that campaigned on better mine safety for, you know, the years leading up to that disaster. We could unfortunately see some of this sort of stuff coming.
Yeah, right. And just going on to Waitangi weekend is coming up pretty soon. What is your reaction to Bill English not deciding not to attend the celebrations after being told he wouldn't be allowed to speak?
Yeah, I just think that's really disappointing. I think, on the day when politicians get to speak in terms of issues of, you know, that you have a debate about and all the rest of it, which is the day before Waitangi Day, there's always been a bit of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing about when you speak, who gets to speak and all the rest of it. I've never known a Prime Minister not to be able to speak at some point, you know, and those sorts of things. But actually, that stuff's irrelevant. It's actually what happens on Waitangi Day itself, the 6th of February. And that day starts with a dawn service and a commemoration on the treaty grounds, the little whare there. And, you know, you have the service there, you come out into the treaty grounds, the dawn breaks and all the rest of it. My view is, it always has been, the Prime Minister should be there for that. That's the time, and there's no controversy about that. That's about starting the day's commemorations, because what the day represents is, you know, the signing of an agreement that brought two peoples together. And however much it's been, you know, trashed and so on in terms of our history, and however much the effort we've taken to kind of reconcile ourselves and repair the harm that has been done over all those years, the reality is the 6th of February 1840 marks the time when agreement was reached that allowed government to be established and brought two peoples together. It's a spirit of unity, and the Prime Minister of the day should be leading the commemorations of that very event, and I just think it's bad for the Prime Minister not to be there.
Yeah, definitely. What are your personal plans for Waitangi? Will you be up there?
Yep, I get there on the 5th of February, so I'll do. You know, I'll go to the Lower Marae, and I don't know whether I'm speaking there or not, but I've been given other opportunities to speak on or around that marae, and then I'll be there for the 6th of February. I'll be at the dawn service. I'll start the day there, and then I'll book my way. I'm going to head down to Auckland after that. I'll go to a couple of other public events in Auckland and end the day in Wellington, where I'll go to another event there too. So, and I just think that's the right way to do it. And that's, you know, the leader of the nation, the Prime Minister, ought to be starting his day in Waitangi and leading off those nationwide celebrations.
Yeah, of course. And just regarding the Mount Albert by-election, so Jacinda Ardern is now going up against Green MP Julie Angenta. What will this, you know, what is this sort of going to reflect about the Labor-Green relationship coming up to the election?
I think, I mean, the reality is that even in the general election, when it comes to the party vote, both parties are going to be competing to maximise their share of the party vote. So in a sense, I think what happens at Mount Albert is a bit of a forerunner of that. But also what it reflects is the fact that we are two parties who have some common ground, but, you know, are out there presenting their credentials to the electorate, and we're trying to get every vote that we can. But we are two parties who have common ground. We have an agreement. We're both committed to representing a change of government and being that part of that change of government. And, you know, this is life for us. So, you know, I'm totally confident that Jacinda and Julianne Genta will campaign in a way that is respectful of each other, but we are, as representatives of two parties, that they are presenting their credentials to the electorate and trying to get every vote they can.
Yeah, right. And I just wanted to ask, what sort of thinking went into behind the Labor and Green Party to host, you know, the joint State of the Nation event? Why did you guys decide to do that?
Well, we signed our agreement, our memorandum of understanding last year. We've been doing various things together in the last sort of 9 months or so, or 7 months since we signed that. And we did want to have an expression to, you know, New Zealand at large to say, listen, you know, the relationship is a real one. It's genuine. We are working together where we can. And so this is about kicking off the year to say, you know, present to New Zealand, here are two political parties presently in opposition, but who represent the possibility of change for New Zealand. So we'll do that. But, you know, as I said, in relation to Mount Albert, we are still two parties, separate parties, also wanting to maximise their vote as well. What New Zealanders will see is that we have, we're parties with some common ground, with the ability to get on and agree, and where we have differences, be respectful about that and be able to resolve those differences.
Yeah, right. Well, that's all we have time for this week. So thank you, Andrew, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. Cheers.
Thank you. See ya. Bye. That was Labour Party leader Andrew Little speaking to us today for his weekly chat. Right, this next thing we have is a report by my producer, Mac.
Yes, this is something I compiled on surveillance in New Zealand.
Stand up! Fight back!
We can't run!
Stand up!
As you may well remember, after the success of the Occupy movement in Wall Street, similar protests launched across New Zealand in 2011.
1 minute, what the police are doing is illegal. Next minute, it isn't. The search and surveillance bill is not good for any New Zealanders. We're on our way to a police state.
That was now Green Party MP Marama Davidson speaking on the 1st of October 2011. The bill she's describing passed the following April, extending surveillance powers granted to the state. Susie Dawson is a Kiwi activist and journalist who worked as a member of Occupy Auckland's media team at that time. Now, 5 years later and following involvement in GCSB and TPPA opposition, she's seeking asylum in Russia, alleging she has been spied on, harassed and threatened by the police. I spoke with Susie and began by asking her why she felt the need to take such measures.
I was already in Russia when I applied for asylum, so I didn't pick Russia as such. It was just that circumstances kind of picked it for me. I had put in Privacy Act requests to the GCSB and to the SIS to ask them up front, hey, am I a target? And I got through those responses from them at the end of September and of last year, 2016. And the nature in particulars of those requests, reading between the lines, made it pretty obvious that yes, I am a target. The GCSB request also tacitly implicated the Office of the Prime Minister, which was really interesting and also really significant. Obviously, John Key, the now-departed Prime Minister, was in fact the Minister in charge of the intelligence agencies. Throughout the period that the GCSB was undertaking illegal spying against New Zealand citizens. So that really combined with other circumstances, political circumstances, through August and September of last year, made it really clear to me that my case was really serious. And I got extensive legal advice throughout the period. And the advice to me was that I was not safe to continue traveling if I am in fact a target. Also in August of last year, The Intercept and TVNZ released the name of the first of the 88 people who was targeted. And he had gone to Australia when he was targeted in New Zealand and had gone to Australia where he was raided and his passport was cancelled. So there was already a precedent for the GCSB target having had their passport cancelled. So given the nature of the legislation that they were trying to pass and the particulars and nature of the responses that came back to me from the spy agencies, the advice to me was that it was too risky for me to travel from that point on because, especially as a solo mother, like of two children, to have my passport cancelled if we were in transit would leave us in a legal grey zone. We would have no idea what would happen to us. If you're in transit, you can't apply for asylum because you're not physically in a country. So I needed to apply for asylum where I was at the time that I received that information.
And what exactly led you to Russia in the first place? I mean, you've talked about being surveilled and harassed by the police while in New Zealand and involved in some of these activities. Is that kind of what drove you to Russia?
In New Zealand, there was a slow escalation. I think initially in the occupation, we were more concerned about interference from undercover police. When the break-ins in my house started and then when we were being followed everywhere and photographed, I think there was multiple agencies, including private contractors involved. So it was private investigators. We know that Auckland Council had hired TCIL, Thompson Clark Investigations Limited, to target occupiers. They are a notorious private investigation agency that have been involved in really dodgy dealings in New Zealand against activists, like infiltrating activist groups, even getting caught sleeping with activists under false identities, assumed identities, GPS tracking activist cars and all kinds of things. But then as I started to work on exposing the role of the FBI and their incursions into New Zealand surrounding the Kim.com raid, and then my work on working against or the GCSB to expose their illegal stuff with New Zealand citizens, and then moving on and my support of Snowden throughout 2013 and Moment of Truth event and leading up into the election, that's when it really escalated and it was abundantly clear that it was no longer just undercover cops or private investigators, but it was actually international intelligence agencies operating in New Zealand as well as the New Zealand intelligence agencies. So that escalation led from 2011 to 2014 to where the dangers to me became very physical and they were absolutely trying to harm me in many ways, but very, very serious ways. And after National won the 2014 election, I was receiving constant threats and I was overtly being told, leave the country or you're dead. Like, that's that simple. So I did what many activists did around the world, who, especially in the English-speaking countries, who experienced similar types of things. And I headed across the world to Berlin in Germany. And I had hoped that leaving New Zealand, that the terrifying things that were happening to me would kind of stay in New Zealand. But unfortunately, it continued. The surveillance and the harassment and the endangerment of me and my family followed me across the world. And that was when I started to realize that these agencies are operating not just in your home country, not even just in the English-speaking countries, but actually in all of the NATO countries. So basically continued to move across a period of time until we got out of the NATO countries, and that was when all of a sudden it stopped. We were no longer being physically harassed and interfered with and surveilled and pressured and endangered. And so we travelled around a few different countries, and we happened to be in Russia at the time that I received back the answers from the agencies and realised exactly how serious my situation was, that up to and including implication, you know, of the Prime Minister. Like, once you discover that your name has been across the Prime Minister's desk and that counter-terrorism resources have been used against you in retaliation for protected democratic practice, you know, journalism and activism is the keystones of democracy. We have the right to dissent. We have the right to seek redress. We have the right to freedom of expression and freedom of association. And all of that had been denied to me. So it was kind of a natural progression. It was never planned from the outset.
These are obviously like really serious allegations. I mean, do you think that New Zealanders, I guess, have their heads in the sand when it comes to surveillance? I mean, how, or is it just kind of something that's exclusive to activism?
I think that Snowden and others, other whistleblowers, have given us the blueprints. Like, they've given us the theory. They've showed us the how, you know, literally the PowerPoint presentations of what these guys do. But myself and other activists and journalists who have experienced this, of which there are many, we are the practical reality of it. Like I say in my documentary, I was literally a housewife from the suburbs. Like, I'm like a white chick from the suburbs who becomes an activist. I should not have counterterrorism resources being used against me. I should not be interfered with through the financing of terrorism and money laundering legislation, but that's exactly what was happening. You know, I'm not a money launderer and I'm not a terrorist, but the legislation passed under those premises was used against me and against other activists and other journalists. I think there's definitely some awareness in New Zealand society because the GCSB movement was bipartisan. I covered all of those events extensively and was very involved in that movement. There, we had every political party except National Enact. You know, we had New Zealand First, we had everybody right across the board participating in the first town hall meeting, for example. It was a broad-based movement. We had the approval of the majority of the country. We had 20 different cities, you know, protesting simultaneously. So people understand that this has been going on, but they haven't really had the practical examples of real targets and what really happens to the people who are targeted by these agencies. We've just had the theory, the knowledge that it is happening, but it's kind of been like this ethereal out there thing. Whereas I think this has really brought home the reality when people hear my story and see the documentary and look into my work, then they realize, wow, you know, these agencies really have been persecuting journalists and activists. I'm really fortunate. I'm extremely fortunate because people knew this was happening to me while it was happening. So it's really not just my word to be taken for it. Since I've spoken up about, especially, I mean, I've talked openly about this for years, but especially in the last few months as it's become more public, there's been a whole series of activists that knew me and worked with me and other people come forward and say, yes, this was happening to her. Yes, to a certain degree, it was happening to us as well. There are many people who've had similar experiences.
And just finally, do you have reason to believe that this conversation is being listened in on by intelligence services?
It's beyond any shadow of a doubt that it is, to be honest with you. I mean, the algorithms are all clustered on keywords, so we're sitting here saying words like intelligence agency and surveillance, and the algorithms will pick that up and they will mark the conversations, and if we are really special, they will be listening live along with us, and if not, they'll be reviewing it after the fact. The degree to which it's now automated is up for debate. Snowden told us what was happening, you know, up until 2013, but even he doesn't know what's happening in 2017. Nobody really does know that. But Absolutely, there'd be an extreme level of interest in this. I mean, I'm the first New Zealand journalist that anyone knows of who has applied for asylum in Russia, but even if we were just two random people having this conversation, there is a very high likelihood that they would be very interested in the contents of it.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was my producer, Mac, speaking to New Zealand journalist Susie Dawson, who is currently seeking asylum in Russia. Now, I don't know if it was just me, Mac, but did I hear a weird beep in that interview?
An oddly timed beep,
I think. Just after you asked if the conversation was being recorded, there was a very eerie, sort of cold beep.
Yeah, almost a Cold War beep, perhaps. You know, that, like, submarine kind of...
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like. And, I mean, if you missed that just then, we'll podcast this interview later and you can check it out on 95bfm.com. But did you ask Susie about that beep? Because you noticed it when you were editing, right?
I did, yeah. I didn't realise how perfect the timing was until kind of going through that interview. But I contacted Susie and I asked her whether she had heard that too, and what she told me was, and I quote, "If you listen to my last radio interview on Voices Network, they complain about the same thing. Same with my non-UK radio interviews. If you listen to Kim.com's court live stream footage, same thing. Julian Assange at Moment of Truth, many of his interviews actually, same thing. Yes, they interfere with audio and with video and with website software and hardware." End quote.
That's pretty crazy.
It is.
I mean, but also part of me thinks, surely they'd be advanced enough to not be leaving tracks like that. Or is that like a warning, like, stop it?
That's what I was thinking, you know. I've read some of others, some of Susie's other interviews, and she spoke about this kind of overt surveillance where they would let you know.
Yeah, right. So it's purposeful.
They're not
hiding it. Wow. Scary stuff. That's The Wire for you. We'll be back after this with our last story. BFM.
When and where did we go cold? I thought I had you on hold.
Out now in this week's BFM Album of the Week, I See You, the hotly anticipated new album from the XX.
The stars and the charts and the cards make sense. Only when we want them to.
After 4 years in the wilderness, London's trio of melancholy synth dreamers return with a brand new album of lilting groups and banging tunes that could only come from the XX. I See You by the XX, out now and 95BFM's Album of the Week. Be listening to Breakfast with Hannah all week to win yourself a copy.
Some time on the road. waiting on the city train to spend some time on the road.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. And remember, if you have anything to say to us about our stories today, don't forget to text us on 5395 and let us know what you think. All right, now time for our next story. Zahara Lari is a competitive figure skater from the United Arab Emirates who has represented her country in international competitions in places like Slovakia, Hungary and Italy. The 21-year-old from Abu Dhabi now has her heart set on a bigger dream, the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea. I spoke to Neve Perrin, a Kiwi filmmaker who has just been granted permission to make a documentary on Lari about her upcoming plans. I started off by asking her to tell me why this figure skater is so special.
Zahra Lari, she's from the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi.
Right, and so yeah. She's a figure skater.
She is. She's a skater from the desert, which is a pretty beautiful notion. Yeah. Couldn't really dream for anything more cinematic than that.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of what's the big deal about her? Like, what is she about to do?
Well, she's aiming to be the very first covered figure skater to ever come out of the United Arab Emirates. And she will also hopefully be the very first person to ever represent the UAE at the Winter Olympics, which is a pretty big deal. So she's conquering a lot of boundaries.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. How did you find out about her?
I actually just stumbled across her when I was meant to be writing another script altogether and came across this like little handheld video that her mum had posted online. And I was like, who is this girl? And started doing like a crazy little Google search and got hooked because she's pretty incredible. Like, she likes to talk about she just wants to be an inspiration to other girls in the UAE but also everywhere in the world, and she calls herself an ambassador for sport, her sex and her religion. So she was pretty fascinating. I was hooked and I actually wrote to her and we became pen pals.
Oh, my God.
But then the pen pal thing didn't last for long because I was like, oh, I just have to make a documentary on you because it's all a bit too exciting and real, and she's just on the cusp of actually making something really big.
That's amazing. And so can you talk me through, how did you get permission to film her for your documentary? How did you go about all of that?
Well, I actually made a little pitch document for her and her management to look over. And they agreed, which was lucky, because my heart was like so far in at that point. And so they gave me the big tick and it's all kind of gone from there. I actually only 2 days ago started submitting my location and filming permits.
Oh, wow.
So it's a whole different process over there, which is really fascinating. So I had to declare that I was unmarried. And also declare my father's lineage. And it was pretty cool. Like,
wow.
I like that. I love that it's different. It's great.
So you're planning to go over to the United Arab Emirates and film the whole documentary and stuff over there, obviously?
So initially our first segment, which is the one that we're gearing up for right now, which is actually only in like 2 weeks' time. So we'll go over there in the first week of February, and we'll start getting to know her house, her ice skating rink, just hanging out, hopefully doing a few more interviews with other people that, you know, really might aid the story and give us a real insight. And then from there, we hope to follow her to a couple of competitions leading up to the Winter Olympics. And then hopefully she makes the right times and gets the right, you know, triple axel and all of that jazz. And if she does that, we'll go to the Olympics with her and film her in South Korea, which will be pretty phenomenal in February next year.
That sounds amazing. It's so interesting. And so have you... So you've set up a fundraising page?
Yes, a little give, a little page. So please help me. There's not much time.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's awesome. It sounds like it's going to be so interesting and, like, totally that thing that she's, I mean, an ice skater from the desert, like.
I think it's just pretty special and beautiful, and she says a lot about, I guess, progress and changing things, and she loves her country, and she's just, like, how inspiring is that to take up something, you know, ice skating in the desert? Imagine being 11 years old and being like, I'm actually going to be a figure skater in the desert. I think that's an incredible ambition to have, just, and then to really, like, set your sights on it, because I've been doing a little bit of research, and there's, like, Most professional figure skaters start at the age of 3.
Right.
So to start at the age of 11, you're already, like, nearly a decade out. so to be, like, on her way to the Olympics is pretty cool.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was documentary filmmaker Neve Purin talking to me about her new documentary she's doing on an awesome figure skater.
That was The Wire.
Yes, it was. That's the end of our show for another week. Very short-lived show with my producer, Mac, who's actually going to be moving to the Tuesday hosting slot next week, aren't you?
I am.
So yep, make sure you tune and listen to that. But good fun for this week. Thanks to those who spoke to us for the show today. Susie Dawson, Margaret Taylor, Andrew Little, Neve Perrin, and Murdoch Stevens. Also a big thanks to Mac, yes, for helping me put together the show today. And of course, thank you to all the listeners for tuning into The Wire this week. We'll be back again next Thursday.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.